Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. It's Friday. Another week has flown by. Thank you all for joining us. Today, we're having a visit from a good friend of ours. It's been a while. He's back with us now to talk about the audiobook version and updated version of his book, Who's Haunting the White House? The President's Mansion and the Ghosts Who Live There. We'll also have a really cool and historical, I guess, theater of the mind today that's really neat, so make sure you stay tuned for that. I got a good creepy vibe going for it as well. Jeff Belanger is an author of numerous books on the paranormal. He's also the lead researcher and writer for the Ghost Adventures TV series and has been since day one. He's here with us now. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Dave, great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, you know what? I always love being a part of this and having you be a part of our world. And, I'm a little biased, I have to be honest, because you put together the Who's Haunting the White House audiobook, and it's great. First of all, folks, an audiobook that's under $5. You can't go wrong. And it's this great historical book that will teach you, and you'll have a great time while you're reading it as well. It's not an educational book in the sense of, oh, God, this is going to be boring. It's all about the ghosts. It's all about the haunted history of this book. And when you did the audio version of it, I know you had many of your friends in the paranormal field do audio bits for you. So voices of presidents and presidents' wives and historians. So that's kind of a cool little aspect of this as well. So thank you for including me in on that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you listen closely, you may hear Darkness Dave Schrader in there. Yeah, no, it was when I started doing this podcast a year ago, and so I've really been getting into the New England Legends podcast, which is just a little 10-minute story a week, just a produced thing about some weird story somewhere in New England. And so I've really been getting into just the idea of this theater of the mind, which is a great segue because you do theater of the mind every Friday. But that's what radio was decades and decades ago. You painted the pictures in your head, and I feel like we've got the means, the technology, and the way to get these stories out like never before. And so I've really been getting into it, and I knew this is the first book I wanted to do as an audio project because it just lends itself to such an array of different voices and so on. And I knew when I was first started working on it, I said, I don't want to read the voices of presidents and first ladies and things like that. That doesn't make sense. We need to get actors in on this. And so I reached out to a bunch of people and people like you, and it was so helpful. And it added so much. It makes such a difference when you hear a different voice. It just really helps fill in that painting that you're listening to.
Well, I bought the audiobook and started listening to it with my kids on the way to school. And what's really cool is there have been a few days when we get home and, it's only a 10-15 minute drive to school and back, that when we get home, they want to sit there and hear the rest of what was just being told. And that doesn't happen often because this, man, I honestly believe this could be the next wave in educational process at school by finding a new way to deliver old messages and by teaching kids about our history. And you know, you've said it before on the show, which I always love and misquote, but the fact that the ghosts are here to kind of remind us of our history, and that's an important lesson. And my kids love this book, and not just because Dad does a voice in it. They don't care. They get to hear Dad's voice all the time. They're kind of annoyed by it at this point, but it's really fun, and there are so many interesting stories. And with this updated version, you take us through all the way through the Obama administration with weird hauntings.
Yeah, so what happens with each presidency is that it's really hard to get ghostly experiences out of any current administration. It's just they're not going to talk about it. They don't need anything to distract distract from the message. They don't need anything to cause any controversy. So you tend to hear these things only, after they're out of the White House. And so, the Obamas had their experiences. I can tell you, really, it's been documented. Every president since Truman, and some before Truman, but every president through and including Truman, has had some sort of paranormal experience that's made it into documentation of some kind, whether it was a letter to somebody, whether it was referenced in an interview, even an off-the-cuff remark. Ronald Reagan, for example, once told a reporter who asked about the house being haunted, and he said, you know, his little dog Rex would bark wildly by the Lincoln bedroom and then at nothing, and then run off. And so, you know, I know that's not exactly groundbreaking, but it's still a comment that he goes, you know, something in there freaks our dog out. It just comes up again and again, and I love how reliable some of these witnesses are when you're talking about the White House. And you know, we live in a time where everything that happens in there is documented. There's an official photographer that follows the president around and gets everything. There are people who write everything down. There's daily press conferences. There's so many elements where we keep track of everything, and that includes the ghost experiences, which I think is pretty cool that this stuff's also getting written down.
Right, and I want to revisit, I want to go to the beginning of this, of course, and tell some of the history and what the first accounts of hauntings were. But you know, one thing that's always fascinated me, and I know they're on file and can be heard. Richard Nixon ran recording nonstop at the White House.
Got him in trouble, didn't it?
It did. But I wonder if anything was ever captured audio-wise.
Like an EVP. Huh. Man. I don't know if I'd want to listen to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours of Richard Nixon's audio to find them.
But I'd like to at least listen to the part where Elvis came to visit him to ask for the badge. That part would be interesting.
Right.
But I just think...
you.
But wouldn't it be interesting? I mean, he had a recording running all the time. I wonder if there was ever any weird anomaly that showed up in any of the recordings. I mean, there was that very strange loss of time that took place in one of the recordings. 13 minutes vanished. Obviously, it's aliens.
Clearly abducted by an alien for 13 minutes and then brought back, clearly. So the thing is, the West Wing, which came around in the 1950s, before the 1950s, there was no West Wing where the president's offices are now and have been since, you know, the 1950s. Before that, the executive office was inside the main building, and it was actually the current Lincoln bedroom. So the Lincoln bedroom was never Lincoln's bedroom. That was the office. That's about where the executive office was.
Wait a minute. The Lincoln's bedroom was never Lincoln's bedroom. How did it end up getting associated with that name?
So it's called the Lincoln bedroom. It's not the Lincoln's bedroom.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's the Lincoln bedroom. The furniture in there did belong to the Lincolns. It is their rosewood furniture. And it's been associated with Lincoln for many, many, many years because of their furniture and because of the name of the room, which obviously honors one of the great presidents we've ever had. So, yeah, but that was the office, and that's where he certainly would have spent a lot of time, arguably more time than he ever spent in his bedroom. So it does make some degree of sense that it would be haunted by the president so profoundly. And those stories come up so often, just from the butlers, the people that take care of the house, the foreman. So many people have had experiences there, from something simple like, you know, the lights flicker. And you could say, okay, the lights flickering, that's not really that paranormal. But, man, it's the White House. No wiring is supposed to be loose or off, right? Everything is top of the line, top grade. There can't be any fire risks. This is checked over by a dozen different people.
Wait, you do realize this is still run by the government.
Yeah, right. I know, that's true. but I mean, this is one of those buildings where you can't be like, yeah, there was a fire because we used this cheap wire and we didn't really check it very well. You know, I mean, you don't ever want to be that guy. You know, yes, we'll mess up your taxes and the laws and everything else, but please, dear God, not these buildings. But you're right. Yeah. But at the same time, when you understand the process of what happens when a new president takes office, It's incredible. Their preferences, like bowling alleys have been put in, basketball courts, movie theaters, you name it. Everything is tailored to the whim and liking of the president and first family. And they spare no expense. They work around the clock to get these things done. And everything is top of the line perfection, because it has to be, because this is kind of like the pinnacle of America. This represents not just the president. It represents every American in some way. It's our house. We pay for it. Our taxes pay for it. That's technically public housing. And it's haunted.
Well, how do I get a room then?
So to get into the living area of the White House,
right?
Because I asked, believe me, you can get into the first floor and tour it. Any American can. It's a little bit more difficult than it was before 9/11, but you can petition your representative, who then you go through a background check and all that other stuff, and you get an appointment. And I think they ask for something like 6 months' notice before you're going to be in Washington, D.C., if you want to tour the White House, so you have time to get an appointment. And then the good news is, unlike how it used to be in the 80s and 90s, where you used to just go and stand outside and wait for, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours in the hopes of getting in, you get an appointment. You show up 15 minutes before, you go through a metal detector, and it's all been arranged, and you get to see the first floor, which is like the East Room and the dining room and all these other, you know, incredible rooms, and you see the paintings and so on, and it's really worth it if you get the chance. But to get upstairs has to be at the invite of the first family, because that's their living quarters. There's no other way to get up there. And those invites come one of two ways. You're either friendly with the first family, or your campaign contributions are so enormous that they just felt obliged to invite you over to stay for a night. And I like to keep my campaign contributions right about zero.
Yeah, so, yeah. But it's a round number, right?
It is, yeah. It's and actually, you can put a lot of zeros after it too, if you want. Put as many as you like. Have at it. So I've yet to warrant an invitation to the living area. However, my sincere hope is that this book is out there and people know about it, and that some haunting event is going to happen that scares the president so much that my phone's going to ring and be like, look, you wrote the book. We need you down here today. The black helicopter just landed in your backyard. Get in it and come on down. And
because other presidents have seen ghosts, but my ghost is the biggest ghost. It's the scariest ghost. It's the ghost that ghosts all the other ghosts, and I need only one man, Jeff Belanger. Is that what you think is going to eventually happen here, Jeff?
I'm telling you, if my call waiting goes off during this interview and I see White House, I'm hanging up. This is over. I'm going to take that call.
I think we simply need to do this. On Fox and Friends, we need to run a story about the haunting of the White House and talk about how all the presidents from Truman on have seen a ghost, so that it only incites our current president to want to come forward, because no other presidents have ever done it during their administration.
Yeah.
I'm telling you,
it's
plant
like the
that seed.
It's like only a fool can't see the ghost.
That's right. Only a fool can't see the ghost. And he's going to have the biggest and best ghost ever. So come, of course, Jeff Belanger can come and just bring your lackey Dave Schrader with you, would you?
Carry the K2 meter, Schrader. Come along. Yes, sir.
But you do
oh,
have
man,
a,
that'd be fun, wouldn't it?
You do have an interesting distinction, because you were the first, weren't you, to be allowed to go there to visit regarding ghosts?
Yeah, because when I called them, this was the first time I went. It was during the Bush administration, second Bush, George W. Bush. And although the administration really had nothing to do with it, I just called the main number and said, hey, who do I talk to about writing a book about the ghost of the White House? And I've gotten better at my approach, you know, over the years. But back then, that's all I said. And they said, well, hold on. And within a minute, I was on the phone with the chief usher. And this is like calling Microsoft and getting connected to the CEO in under 60 seconds. I mean, the chief usher is the CEO of the White House. That's the person that about 100 employees report to. And that's the cleaning crew, the groundskeepers, the butlers, all these folks. And they're not really affiliated with any administration. They stay, you know, and serve whatever president's in the White House, whatever political party, it doesn't matter. And some of these folks have been there for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, and they've got stories. They've put in more time in that building than any president, even a two-term president. I mean, if you're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week for 30, 40 years, that's just more time than even a two-term president. So they have ghost experiences. And when I called and I said, hey, I want to do this book about the ghosts of the White House, he said, yeah, we're not interested. And I said, but I think we can use ghosts as a way to teach history to kids. You know, we can use the ghost to teach the history. And he said, go on. And from there, we kept talking, and he invited me down, and with the help from my congressman and with a background check and all that other stuff, I got to go down there, and I got to interview him, and I guess
wait a minute,
Gary
help,
Walters. It was amazing.
Help from your congressman. What, you need a congressman in order to – you need like kind of a referral to say you're an okay Joe to get in?
And actually, it gets better. And for all of you pundits out there, you're about to get mad, but I assure you, it works works this way for both parties. During that time, Bush is a Republican president, and my congressman is a Democrat. And I called and said, "Look, I need to go down there to work on this children's book." And da da da. And they said, "Oh, so it's really hard for Democrats to get their constituents in the White House when there's a Republican president." And so they said, "So here's what we're going to do." So they called the person I spoke to called her counterpart at Congressman Daniel Lipinski's office, who I believe was from Illinois, who's a Republican, and said, "Hey, I need you to get one of my constituents in for a project." And so I technically went as a guest as Congressman Lipinski, but it was a favor called in by Congressman Richard Neal. And while that sounds really horrible, I'm told it absolutely works the other way, too. So when a Democrat's president, the Republican people have to call in the – and that's why Lipinski was so happy to do it, because he knows one day there'll be a Democrat in there and he's going to be calling my guy and saying, "Hey, I need you to get one of my people in." And they just do it, one of these favors that you do for each other. So so I went – thanks to two congressmen. Now there's new two congressional offices getting me into the White House. And it was a really amazing experience. Have you been in there, Dave? Have you ever got to see it as a kid or anything?
No. Something, I don't know, what's restraining order? I'm not sure what this is, but, you know.
150 yards or something, like, it's pretty from a distance. It's really incredible when you walk up that North Portico and you're standing there, and you're like, this is the White House, man. Every single U.S. president stood right where I'm standing. And that is a powerful thing. And I know you've experienced that, Dave, where, we've talked about this, where you go to some historic haunted location and you look down at your feet and you say, man, history was made right here, right where I'm standing. And you feel that. And that's not a psychic thing or whatever. That's just connecting to the tapestry that is humanity. You know, you look down and know history left a mark right where I'm standing, right. And that's why I'm here, and that's why it's haunted.
Twice I've had that standing over the USS Arizona in Hawaii.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. This one, please don't think that I'm marginalizing the importance of the presidency by saying this, but when we made our trip to Germany, they took us to one of the fairgrounds, and I stood in the exact spot where Adolf Hitler delivered this massive speech to tens of thousands of people. And you're like, my God, this space that I'm standing, this exact space, and there's photographs, it's the same railing, it's every, you're like, I'm, you know, this is a horrific part of our world, but for one moment, I was sharing the exact same space in time and space that this horrific leader once stood and addressed all of these people. And it impacts you, because not only is it just kind of I'm standing in a place of history, but like you said, you can feel it. There is a palpable sense when you stand in some of these places of what took place there and just how powerful a moment that was. And I got to tell you, you know, over the USS Arizona, I got very emotional and have no idea why. And there were a group of men. None of us knew each other. And we all began just crying like babies on this, you know, you're on this landing above the USS Arizona. And it all happened at once. So there was something that moved through us. And then when we were all there in Germany, standing on this platform and on this veranda looking out, you had this kind of, in not that kind of sense, but just that impactful moment of, my God, what took place here? This was unbelievable. And it is weird how you can still feel that vibe. It is really locked in the space-time continuum right there. I think that's ever looping.
And see, that's where, and we've had discussions about this when we're talking about the paranormal, that I don't think the paranormal exists without people. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, you are a part of the experiment. You're one of the ingredients in the stew. You're a variable in this equation. And so when you stand there and when you know what happened, when you have an understanding of history, and it doesn't even have to be that in-depth of an understanding, just even a high-level one, it's called human empathy. And if you lack it, you're a psychopath, literally. Like, you're a technical psychopath. They lack human empathy. You are connecting with the emotions and the feelings of the people that were there before you. So you have, in the case of like the USS Arizona, I mean, of course. I mean, you start imagining, what if I were on that boat and just doing my duty, and all of a sudden this attack came out of nowhere, and I'm stuck and in a sinking ship, and my comrades, and we're trying to help and trying to fight back and defend the homeland and all that stuff. Like, these people died for that. And you connect to it because you're a human being and you also have thoughts and emotions. And that's a good thing. It's a very good thing. And I think that's why it's so important that we preserve some of these historic sites. And it's so important that even when it's bad history like Hitler, it's important that it's preserved. You should stand there. Stand where he stood and look out and imagine that what became of speeches like the one given right there. And don't let it happen again. You know, take the lesson of Hitler. Don't let it happen again. Don't let there be another Hitler. Don't let there be another USS Arizona. Don't let your guard down. There's a lesson to learn. And I think that's why I've said, you know, ghosts are history demanding to be remembered. We have to remember. We have to talk to it. We have to connect to it. And to bring it back to the White House, one of my favorite elements of the White House is there's two spots on the building, the front side and the south side, right near a window, where you can see burn marks from August of 1814, when the White House was burned to the ground. All the wood inside was burned. The stone walls were able to withstand it. But those burn marks were never painted for a reason. They could have. We've got the money. We've got the time. We've got the ability. That building gets painted, you know, top to bottom almost every single year, so it's perfectly pristine and white. But these two windows, there's a little spot where they leave it unpainted because it's a reminder. It's a ghost from 1814 that still haunts us. This building was burned to the ground. The city was sacked by British redcoats, and it could happen again. Don't forget. And so for that reason, we don't paint this little spot. And for that reason, we still talk about the ghost of the British redcoat that's seen outside near the North Portico. And we talk about the ghost of Lincoln. And we talk about all these things because we are trying to connect with history. Because if you don't connect to it, you are truly doomed to repeat it.
Well, let's start getting into the haunted history and the first recollections or first notes of hauntings taking place there. When we look at the history of the White House, Jeff, and you'd mentioned that every president has been there. I thought there was a point when this wasn't the actual residence. There was another place, and then this became the place. Do you know much about
that?
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Yeah, so the George Washington never lived in the White House. He laid the cornerstone. He was there during the construction, but he passed away before it was built. And he and John Adams was actually the first president, second U.S. president, but the first president to live in the White House. And when he moved in, it wasn't even finished. I mean, there was still exposed walls. There was still construction going on. And more than anything, there was no furniture in the whole building. There was no money for it. They had enough money to build this mansion, but no money to furnish it. And so John Adams moves in and says, okay, this is just this big empty building. And it's kind of metaphoric, really, because we're building a country, too, at the same time that we're building this house. So in some weird way, I guess it makes some sense.
What are the oldest recollections of a possible haunting taking place there that you were able to uncover?
So the first story I heard about was, as I mentioned, when the Adamses moved in, it was empty. And the East Room, which is where they put the big dining table and so on, had nothing in it. And so Mrs. Adams had said to the servants, well, why go outside and face the elements when we've got this big empty room? So they would hang the laundry and do the laundry in the East Room and just attach ropes across the walls. And one of the earliest stories was about how people would smell soap and hear the sloshing of water and see an apparition hanging laundry in the East Room. And it made some think, well, you know, wow, maybe there was a home here before the White House. There wasn't. It was built on land donated by Mr. Burns, which comes up again as well. And so, but historically what was happening was, I think we were seeing almost like a replaying of those servants hanging laundry during the first administration to live in the White House. And that was John Adams. And Mr. Burns comes up again because his name was heard echoing in the building. In fact, I forget which presidency it was at this point, but it was someone was walking through the main building and heard, "I'm Mr. Burns." And she thought it was actually one of the president's assistants, who is named Burns but spelled differently, but then found out he wasn't even in the building that day. And so she had heard this echoey voice from the past. So these little things come up early on. But the first ghost that I found truly documented, written down.
Let me ask you one thing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Stop right there.
Do it.
With the two original hauntings you just mentioned, kind of this residual effect, and then this voice calling out. You know, I understand the ghost of the British soldier that might have died there on that spot, or having breached that section and been a part of burning the White House, so there was that kind of emotional attachment to that area. And I know and understand some of the other parts of the history there, but why do you think something as simple as washing the sheets, why do you think that is something that's remembered? Why do you believe that is a part of the haunting and is a locked memory? It just seems like that's kind of a mundane haunt.
It's pretty boring, right?
Right.
I get it. And so I think this touches to, I've also said, any legend exists for a reason. And when I call something a legend, please don't think that or interpret that as me saying it is a made-up story or false. There are plenty of examples of legends, in our daily life. Art Bell, right, who just passed away. A legend in radio, right? The story of Art Bell is bigger than the man himself. That's what a legend means.
Right.
And so legends stick around because we need them for some reason. This one, I would interpret as the metaphor I mentioned before, that when the White House was built, America was just a few years old and had no furniture. It had nothing. We were starting from nothing. And so I love the idea that we would be haunted by this residual idea, movie playing over and over of these servants hanging laundry in the East Room. At one point, this building had nothing in it, nothing to fill it, just like the country, brand new, empty. And we had to build it over time. And we built it by, every means necessary. And at one point, we made use of this room just by hanging laundry in it. And by remembering that, this building wasn't poofed into existence full of great paintings and furniture and art from all over the world and so on. It was empty. We had to fill it one piece at a time, and we're still doing that. That still happens with every presidency. New carpet comes in, new pieces of furniture come in, new antiques get swapped out and brought in or whatever. That's still happening. The story's still being written. So I love the idea that the White House was once a blank page. It's an empty book, a journal that had to get filled over time.
All right. I get the point of that, and that I've talked, and you and I have talked off air about the kind of time travel theory I have of how places exist and every occurrence is kind of a page in that book. You know, the top cover being the end of time, the back cover, the beginning of time, and all of those things that kind of coexist in the exact same area. And sometimes those pages just get wet and you get a flicker of the writing that was behind the next page. That is pretty interesting about that. Is there anything we know about the area, you know, that would make it conducive to haunting? Is it built on a bed of granite and limestone? Is there anything specific to the source of the environmental issues that may be causing this place to be so powerful?
I don't know about that as much as if you consider this, it is a sacred place now, you know, and what happens over time is that any piece of land, like there's a whole transition, right? Any location, any building, rock, tree, canyon, whatever it is, you name it. If enough people pay attention to it, it becomes a point of interest. If people then go out of their way to visit that place, whatever or wherever it is, it starts to grow beyond point of interest to kind of like legend status. Legend can grow to mythic status, and mythic can grow to sacred. You know, so a place like Stonehenge in England is a sacred site because people have been going there for thousands of years. And today we don't even know why we go there. We go there because it's famous and we want to see it and ponder the question for ourselves. But we are drawn to it and we don't even fully understand why, because it is sacred. And it doesn't matter if it's built on limestone or ley lines or underground rivers or whatever. At this point, all that human energy over thousands of years has made that place sacred. The same thing is true of the White House. So many decisions that have affected the whole world, but especially this country, have been made in that building and on those grounds. tens of thousands of people have died because of decisions made around in that building. Maybe that was the right decision. Maybe it was the wrong decision. History may judge that one day. But the reality is lives were lost. Lives were saved. So many experiences in the whole human spectrum went down because of the influence of things that happened within that building. That is, I mean, that's as bigger than a cathedral, bigger than, you know, I mean, we're talking like Vatican status now, if you think about it, as far as like a sacred space. Although we don't think about it in religious terms, I think that's the best analogy when you're talking about a place like the White House.
All right. Now, you started to take us down the path of some of the other weird hauntings that took place there. Let's get into that before we go to Theater of the Mind.
Yeah, so the first documented ghost story that I found was took place in the 1860s, and it was during the Lincoln administration. And President Lincoln had the most difficult presidency of all of them, hands down. There's not even a close second. Lincoln's country is at war with itself, and that's just horrific to go through as a president. And the biggest tragedy that happened to his family during that time is that his young son, Willie, died of a typhoid-like disease in the White House. So he got sick, and suddenly 2 weeks later, he passes away. And this kid was something special. I mean, he was beloved by the family, but he was even loved by servants and other political officers and so on. Everybody just adored this kid, and it broke the president's heart. And it broke his Mary Todd's heart as well. She started having these dreams where she would wake up and she would see Willie Lincoln with his uncle Alec, who also died as a child, standing at the foot of her bed. And she wrote in letters to her sister Emily that he lives, he's still around, and he's with his uncle Alec, and it gives me great comfort to know that he's not alone in this eternal beyond. And so she writes about that, and you could say, okay, this is a really distraught mother who just misses her child so much she's having dreams about them, and you might dismiss it, and I understand that. But we also know Mary Todd Lincoln was holding seances in the White House to try to contact her son, and the president attended at least one of these meetings. But decades later, in the early 1900s, a military aide writes in his memoirs about how he visited the White House and learns that the maids were claiming that it's haunted by the ghost of a little boy. And the only little boy to die there was Willie Lincoln 40 years earlier. So that's really interesting to me that it does come up again. And again, this is us connecting to the past and imagining that. I mean, you're a dad. You know the worst thing that could ever happen to anybody is that something happens to your kid. And that was true of Lincoln. It's true of us. It's true then. It's true now.
Have there been eyewitnesses of this little boy even in current days?
I haven't heard any stories really in the last 50, 60 years of the little boy. And I think probably because he's been he's just been overshadowed by his dad. President Lincoln has become by far the most prominent ghost of the White House. Even though there are others that have turned up over the years, Lincoln is just the most profound. And I think he's there, and maybe you might want to save this part of the discussion for after Theater of the Mind. I think he's there because he's such a benchmark in so many ways. He's a benchmark of how hard it can get in the White House, and that whatever you have going on, he had it tougher, and you can get through it if you're the president.
The stories that surround that are pretty impressive, and we'll get into that. But, just as a weird little historical aside, his son went on to become someone that was witness to three presidential assassinations. That's insane, right? I mean, talk about just being the bad luck charm. I mean, he ended up where he refused to meet with any more future presidents, right? Do you remember which son was that?
His one son was Willie, and the other was what were the other two's names? As you can imagine, it's tough to keep track of all
that. Right? Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw you under on that one. I just
no, it's okay. I did put it in the book too. I'm trying to flip through my notes at the same time. But yeah, it was these kids too. People from all over the country were sending them gifts. It was Robert, William, and Thomas, and William was the one who died. So Robert and Thomas were the remaining sons. And people from all over America would send these kids gifts of, like, farm animals. They would get ponies and dogs and sheep and so on. And they used to build forts on the roof of the White House. And they really, the Lincolns really seemed to enjoy their family time, seemed to really get along and enjoyed being a family. And so, you know, this event would really break them up. But, yeah, I'm not sure if it was Robert or Thomas.
Yeah, it's Robert. According to this interesting deal, his quote, Robert Todd Lincoln, known as the presidential jinx, he was on record as stating, there is a certain fatality to presidential functions when I am present. He's the only person in history that has been witness to and involved in three different U.S. presidential assassinations. In 1865, when Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater in Washington, his son Robert was immediately called to his father's side. He was there comforting his mother when his father died the next day. 15 years later, in 1881, Lincoln was Secretary of War under President James Garfield. He came to Washington Street to see the president off on a trip. Just as he arrived, a disgruntled office seeker gunned down the president. Lincoln was at Garfield's side within a few seconds of the shooting. And then finally, some 20 years after that, in 1901, Lincoln was on the way to the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, when President William McKinley was there making a speech. When he received word that President McKinley had been shot by an anarchist, Lincoln rushed to his side. McKinley was expected to recover from the gunshot, but died a week later. So in the life of Robert Todd Lincoln, he was witness to three presidential assassinations. That's...
Can you imagine you're another president? And you're like, could you just please stay far, far away from me? Like,
and that's what he agreed to do after that. He said he would never make another public appearance or go to where the president was going to be. We're going to take a break. Speaking of history and the ghosts that remind us, this was one of the more powerful stories we'd ever received. I hope you enjoy it. It's our next edition of Theater of the Mind.
This week's Theater of the Mind revisits history. I remember the day. A true life encounter from Jared Benson. Dallas was abuzz with excitement. The president, our president, was in Texas for a visit. There was huge fanfare, excitement, and a parade-like atmosphere. To say our family were Kennedy supporters was a bit of an understatement. We were fervent servants. My Aunt Evelyn was among the biggest of all. Aunt Evie, as we called her, prattled on and on about JFK like he were her own son. I think she may have rivaled even Joe and Rose in the pride department when it came to Jack, as she called him. It was November of 1963. On this day, our family was knocked out of commission with what I think could only be akin to a version of the Black Plague. We were all down and out, sick, fevery, achy. It was horrible. Other than that, it was just another day in Dallas. We had congregated in a small breakfast nook in our home to partake in my mother's soup, trying to find resiliency in the ultimate of comfort food. The grandfather clock in the hall rang out with a powerful single bong to mark the time. It was 12:30. A few minutes later, the phone rang. Mom stood up, shuffled across the kitchen floor, and grabbed the receiver of our lime green home phone hanging on the wall.
Benson residence,
she chirped. Immediately, her expression changed.
I'm sorry, who is this? Who? Evie? What are you saying?
With that statement, we all turned to look at Mom. I don't think anyone breathed the entire time she held the phone.
Who was shot? Who's dead? When? Oh my Lord, what? How is this possible? How is this possible?
She cried out in astonishment and tormented pain. My father stepped up and approached my mother. For God's sakes, Margaret, who is that? What's going on? He barked out. With that, Mom turned to him. Her eyes rolled straight back up in her head, and the phone slipped from her hand, striking the floor. Just moments before she did, she fell to the ground in a heap. We all leaped up and ran to her. My father was already cradling her, stroking her face, trying to rouse her back to consciousness. I reached for the phone to see what was going on and who was there, and I was met with an annoying, shrill sound, the screeching that phones made in that day when they were left off the hook. I stood up and replaced the phone on the silver hook and turned my attention to my parents. My mom was coming to at this point and shaking quite badly.
Bob... It was Evie. She said Kennedy had been shot. He's dead. It was Evie, Bob. It was Evie.
Dad tried to calm her. That can't be right, Marge. She's in a coma. The stroke. The stroke, honey. She had a stroke, he said, almost trying to convince himself. I snapped on the TV and we waited with anticipation as the TV crackled to life. I checked the stations, but there was no mention of Kennedy, a shooting or anything of its kind. It was some jackass kid pulling a prank, Dad assured Mom.
No, Bob, it was Evie,
she sobbed. Dad called the hospital and checked on Aunt Evie. She was there, still very much in a coma and unresponsive. Dad was reminded of our appointment with the doctors the following day to make a very hard decision. The rest of our day was uneventful and Mom eventually calmed down. The following morning, as a family, we went to say goodbye to Aunt Evie. The stroke was extensive, and she was completely unresponsive and living only with the aid of machines. It was November 22nd in Dallas. We sat in the room, taking turn holding Aunt Evie's hands, saying our goodbyes and sharing fond memories and our fair share of tears. When suddenly, the hospital sprang to life. There were cries from down the hall. Doctors and nurses filled the rooms. All eyes were on the TV. It was about 12:40 p.m., and news was being reported that JFK had been shot and was in transit to the hospital. We exchanged baffled looks. Our mouths hung open in pure confusion. It was exactly 24 hours since we received that call from Aunt Evie, my comatose aunt, the one that didn't have a phone in her room, that called to tell us Kennedy had been shot and was dead one day before it happened. Like the rest of the world, we sat transfixed to the TV, KRLD in Dallas, watching the story unfold before our very eyes. We were aghast as the sound of police sirens screamed outside the hospital. They were bringing the president here, to Parkland Memorial, where Aunt Evie lay in a comatose state.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom, and there has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air.
As you can imagine, there are many stories that are coming in now as to the actual condition of the president. One is that he is dead. This cannot be confirmed. Another is that Governor Connally is in the operating room. This we have not confirmed. The president was whisked from the scene of the attempted assassination, or assassination depending upon his condition, of course, at this hour, by bus to Parkland Hospital, and the president undoubtedly is in the emergency room at that hospital, which would be on the first floor of Parkland. No word as yet. We are awaiting something more official. It is, of course, difficult, certainly, to go on scanty reports.
Within 30 minutes of arriving, Aunt Evie let out a gurgling sob, and a single tear rolled down her cheek, and she slipped away. Our attention turned back to the television set and newscaster Walter Cronkite.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
That day in Dallas, Texas, we lost a true American, someone that stood for all the things that are good and right in the world. Love, family, and commitment to our country. Oh yeah, we lost our president too. I will never forget where I was that day, or the day before Kennedy was killed.
Beyond the Darkness.
Who's haunting the White House, the President's Mansion, and the ghosts who live there? Jeff Belanger, our guest, as we're talking about the haunting of one of the most famous residents in the world. His book is out in hardcover, paperback, and now audiobook. And I recommend you get the audiobook, not just because I do one of the voices, but for $4.87, you can't go wrong. It's a great book, and it's something fun to share. And download it. It's something you can listen to in the car with your kids. You can share with them while you're out on the boat fishing or hanging out. It's a great book, a lot of fun, very educational, but it's all done with this interesting twist of sharing these ghost stories. And the theater of the mind, man, that story to me was kind of an interesting, impactful story and a weird case of, you know, what is consciousness, right? We've talked about, over the years about these random number generators that seem to start picking up on something grand happening, sometimes up to 24 hours before it actually occurs, and then settling afterwards. And it's something before the world's global consciousness is even aware of it happening. And in this case, this woman in a coma seemed to know and reach out from beyond where she was to share this information. That was a weird, eerie story to me.
It was definitely weird. And I think that one of the things that you can't overstate is just who Kennedy was, this charismatic guy that was beyond. I mean, he was a legend even when he was alive. You know, he was this this young charismatic guy that really resonated with a lot of people. So Americans felt very connected to him. And anytime a president is assassinated, you know, remember when the attempt was made on Reagan in the 1980s?
Yes.
It was a big deal. Reagan was shot. And we haven't really seen a assassination of a president in our lifetime, and that's a testament to how good the the Secret Service has gotten and so on. But every American suddenly feels vulnerable. It's that powerful of an experience. Well, man, if someone can get to our president, what else could they do? That's why it's so important to protect the president. It really is, like, because it speaks to all those issues. But I remember when I interviewed the chief usher at the White House, Gary Walters, and I made some comment. I said, wow, you've been here for decades, and I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you didn't vote for the person who won every time, that maybe you have supported a different candidate, and that's not who won in every single case. And he said, I serve the presidency. And I realized that's why the Secret Service calls the president POTUS, right? They don't take a bullet for Trump or for Obama or for Bush. They wouldn't do that. They would take a bullet for the presidency, because the presidency is like this top of the pyramid for all of America. So when they would take a bullet for the presidency, they would take a bullet for you and for me and for all of the country. And that is how these folks think about it. And that's the mystique, the legend, the thing that grows around the living president. And so when Kennedy was assassinated, that is such a huge, huge deal. That happened before I was born, and I know before you were born, right? Or was it?
Yes, it was. Four years before.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I was born on November 22nd, 1967, so my birthday is forever tied to one of the most dark days in American history.
Right, and then there's also the Kennedy assassination.
Ouch, man.
Sorry.
Real ouch.
Sorry, that was horrible. I'm terrible. I'm a bad person. We are all hyper-connected to this office, and so that theater of mine, that blew me away, too. That was pretty spooky.
You know, it's interesting, too. If you look back at it, even though there was, you know, I grew up not really understanding the allure of Kennedy, because everything I read about him and his family just sounded like, oh, a bunch of dirty moonshiners eventually made their way and bought their way into the presidency, which I know I've just pissed off a portion of my audience. But to me, that's kind of the way it was relayed later on. But there is still this Camelot feel to that, and that's what they referred to it as. But there was this, they were kind of the royal family of the United States. And I don't think there's ever been anything even close to that sense since.
No, not the mystique of Kennedy. I don't think so. I don't think we've had that. Obama probably came the closest, I think, because, the first black president and things like that. I think he came close to that sort of mystique, but I don't think any other rivals Kennedy.
But even in that sense, like you said, I mean, that was a precedent-setting moment when Obama became president. But the complete full richness of that royal family feel, where everybody in the family was an important cog. I mean, it was like having a, you know, King John and Queen Jacqueline, and then you've got, you know, Prince John Jr. and, you know, and Princess Caroline. And then you've got, you know, the Duke of Windsor over here as Robert Kennedy. And it just, everybody kind of had that position. With Obama, it was, you know, him and Michelle and his kids. There wasn't that grand scope of this kind of, this eternal family. You know, you've got Ted, the court jester. You've got everybody kind of involved situation.
And all in politics.
Like a dynasty. I mean, the Bushes, in a sense, but nowhere near the regality or the charisma, I guess I would say, that the Kennedys seemed to have. And people just overlooked, where they came from, what they did. It just didn't seem to matter. He was the voice and the look of a new generation. And it's weird that America has changed so drastically since then.
Yeah, it really has. And I think I forget which British comedian it was where he said, maybe it was like John Cleese or someone, who said, only in America do Americans grow up looking for America. You know, so when you grow up in England, you don't go looking for England. And what we mean when we say we're looking for America is we're looking for that identity. Who are we? I think it's easy to forget just how big this country is. I know we're not the biggest in the world as far as landmass and even population and so on, but it's really diverse. You've got seacoasts, and you've got deserts, and you've got great plains, and you've got farm country, and you've got the South and the North and everything in between. And that's a lot of disparate, different people with different ideas and so on. And so how do we unify something like that? No one's unified Europe. I mean, I know there's the European Union and they're getting on one currency, but think about it. Imagine driving from Pennsylvania to New York, and now there's a whole other language. There's a border crossing. There's passports that need to be involved and so on. That's what Europe is like. They maintain their separate languages, identities, and so on. And yet we are this American experiment and experience. We're trying so hard to find some sort of national identity. And it's tricky. It's really tricky. I think after World War II, it might have been a little easier because the identity is, hey, we know what team we're on. We're on the American team and the team of the Allies. You know, we got attacked at Pearl Harbor. We got attacked even on the mainland was attacked. Gosh, in Astoria, Oregon. Warrenton, Oregon. Fort Stevens was attacked by the Japanese. I learned rather recently there were bombs dropped on the mainland, but people don't talk about it because no one died. It was just one of these, you know, this Japanese sub kind of motored in and just tried to pick at something. And so so at that point, you had a nation that was unified after that event. We were probably unified after 9/11 in a way that we hadn't seen in decades. But we haven't had a 9/11 event since, and I think we've forgotten what it's like. And it's a shame that we can only seem to get on the same page when we're attacked.
Yeah, that's a brutal shame, and I hope that we never have to endure that again. You know, talking about Kennedy, and especially with the brutality of his death, has there been any stories that you've been able to uncover regarding, you know, JFK or RFK at all?
Shockingly, no. I have not heard stories, and you would assume, you would think that would make all the sense in the world that there would be ghost stories related to Kennedy because of the figure that he was, and yet no, I haven't encountered any discussion of ghosts of Kennedy. Not at all. And that was curious to me because that's one, you know, of course Lincoln comes up because of who he is. And you'd think Washington comes up, yet he doesn't, but he was never really in the building. And maybe that's the reason, you know, he died before it was completed. It's these figures that are so, that leave a mark more than others. And of course, Kennedy, like Lincoln, paid the ultimate price for the office, but still it's curious that his name doesn't come up.
All right, now you've talked about Willie Lincoln having been seen there, and the fact that Mary Todd Lincoln actually held seances there that her husband participated in, and you know we've heard all of these different kind of tales from back then. And you talk about the red coat that's seen. Is there any kind? Is he like a harbinger by any chance? Is he seen prior to or before anything known, or what? When does he seem to make his appearances?
So that's one of those stories that has come up where I feel like no one I talked to said they saw them directly, just they knew about it. Even a Secret Service agent I had interviewed had said, yeah, I've heard stories about that British redcoat. And it's just like always like one of these like, oh, friend of a friend or, you know, colleague of a colleague. But there is a harbinger of sorts, but it, ironically, it's not a person. There's a black cat ghost that's been seen in the lower levels of the White House. And that seems to be a harbinger. I believe they said he showed up before the stock market crash. He's showed up before World War II and events like that. When you see the black cat in the White House, that's said to be a harbinger. And there's also another black cat ghost at the Capitol building that's also said to be a harbinger. So basically, if you ever see a black cat in Washington, D.C., run, I guess, is the moral of the story. Just be like, uh-oh, something's about to go down. Get out.
What are some of the other ghosts that you were able to uncover?
So again, you know, Lincoln by far the most prominent, but there's a curious one that showed up outside of the White House on the grounds in the Colonial Rose Garden, and that we believe was Dolly Madison. And in 1913, Woodrow Wilson had just become president, and he and his wife, First Lady Ellen Louise, was the first lady then. She wanted to make some changes, as so many first families want to do. They want to put their own thumbprint on that building and not just on the nation. And so she ordered the Rose Garden to be dug up. And so some workers go out there, and they're about to put the shovel into the ground. And suddenly there's this dark-haired, round-faced woman standing there wagging her finger at the workers. And they drop the shovels, they run for it. And everyone said that that must have been Dolly Madison, who planted the original garden and took a lot of pride in it. So it's not just presidents, it's also first ladies that come up.
Well, talking about workers, probably one of the most famous ghost images surrounds the White House, right? Isn't there a famous photograph while they were kind of excavating and rebuilding on that they captured? And what do you think, weighing in on that, what do you think that is?
So what you're talking about, in 1950, the White House was completely gutted. They ripped everything out inside, all the walls, everything. The building was pretty old, and you have to realize all the modern conveniences and things that had been brought in. It was straining the building. So they completely gutted it, and they dug down something like three stories to put in basements and sub-basements and so on. That's when they added the East and West Wings. So it was May 25th, 1950, and the White House was going through this gutting. And the official White House photographer, Abby Rowe, goes there to take a picture of the progress to document this, because this is the world we live in. And you see earth movers and dump trucks, and you see this different workers standing all around. And way back in the corner, there's this guy standing there who's like semi-transparent. You can see the wall behind him. You can see that he's just this ghostly shape. And at first pass, it's easy to say, well, you know, this is an old photo, an old camera, and he's so far away from the lens, he must be, you know, just couldn't focus on it. But if you look to that figure, if you look left of that figure, there are three men standing there who are perfectly solid. You can see one of them's wearing a tie, one of them is wearing a white hat and a light-colored shirt and dark-colored pants. You can see all the detail on those guys that are just as far away as this figure. But yet this figure, which looks visually to be standing about maybe 15 feet from those three men, is transparent and see-through. And it's really weird, and I can't explain it. And I love the fact that I can't explain it. It's actually on my website. If you go to jeffbelanger.com and click on the book, Who's Haunting the White House, the audiobook, I put those photos in there because we talk about it in the audiobook. And I know it's one of those things that people would want to see. So you can go ahead and check it out if you want to click on it.
Very cool. So again, where can they find that picture?
It's jeffbelanger.com, and if you look on the homepage, just click on the book cover for Who's Haunting the White House, the audiobook, and it will take you right to that page. And if you scroll down, I put the full image and the close-up so you can see for yourself.
It is weird, right? I mean, like you said, you've got a guy in the foreground in focus, because my thought at first was, too, maybe it was a long-timed exposure. Somebody had walked in briefly and then walked back out, but everybody else, there's no movement blur. I mean, it's just old and blurry, but it's not movement blur. It's not like a prolonged exposure.
No, and like I said, to me, if those three guys standing nearby weren't there, I'd say, it's just, he's just far away from the lens. You got to, you know, that old 1950 camera, you got to give him a break. But the fact that there's clear detail in the three guys standing near him tells me that I think this could be more than just an anomaly, because why would it focus, you know, on the three guys and not – you have to see the picture to understand this. You know, by all means, go check it out. I think it's something weird.
Who surprised you most as you were doing the research for this book that claimed to have had a paranormal experience there?
Definitely Harry Truman. So President Truman wrote about the ghost something like 6 or 7 different times in letters to his wife on official White House stationery and everything. To quote the president, he was alone one night and he described how he was getting ready for bed and his wife and daughter were somewhere else. So it was just him on the in the living area of the White House. And he hears someone walking around. So he gets up and he looks and he's like, well, who's up here? No one's supposed to be up here. And he keeps hearing the walking around, so he goes downstairs and he talks to the Secret Service agent who are on the first floor and stationed. That's where they're supposed to be. They keep guard to make sure no one goes upstairs to where the president is at night. He's not to be disturbed. And they say, well, who's up here? Are you sending an agent up? And they say, no, sir, we're down here where we're supposed to be. But he keeps hearing the footsteps. On another occasion, he's here, like, knocks on the wall. Hear the footsteps in the very room. He mentioned the ghost again and again to his wife, Bess. And to quote the president, the damn place is haunted. Sure is shooting. And I love that. I love that he just talked about it very matter of fact. He didn't seem afraid, but it was enough to wake him up repeatedly, and that it warranted documenting on several different occasions in the 1940s.
Sure is shooting.
Place is haunted.
It's haunted. All right. In researching in this, I mean, you're looking at these archives and these letters. I would have thought the government would have been a little bit more careful. Maybe that's the wrong word, but they would have been a little bit, that would have been stuff that might have been redacted or things, because again, you know, you don't want your presidents to sound crazy. You don't want them. And there are so many people that don't believe in that. You
sure.
know, was it kind of surprising to you that you were able to find as much as you were?
I called every presidential library, and this is a resource that's available to all Americans. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm looking for any reference to ghosts in the White House. And the various libraries were very helpful. And what's interesting, when I called the George H.W. Bush Library, that's the first Bush president, and I said, I'm looking for references to ghosts of the White House. When I first did the research, they said, well, we've got 2 references here, but they're classified. And I went, oh, well, now I'm like 6 times more interested. You know, like, I was interested before. Now I'm really, really interested. And I said, so what do we do? He said, would you like to file for Freedom of Information Act to get these declassified? And I said, yes, I would like to do that. So we do the Freedom of Information Act. And when the first printed book came out, I had forgotten about it because I didn't hear back. These things don't happen overnight. And then the original book came out, and something like 7-8 months later, I get a letter in the mail saying, we have declassified one of the 2 documents you requested. And I went, oh my, I mean, this is like, you know, Christmas morning, you know, opening this letter going, oh my God, I'm about to get to look behind the curtain. This is amazing. And it was a handwritten letter from President George H.W. Bush to the author David McCullough, who writes those great history books about, you know, John Adams. They're huge, thick, phone book-like books, you know, that he writes on historical figures. And the handwritten letter said, you know, dear Mr. McCullough, either the White House really is haunted, or the thunderous applause from your lecture last night is still reverberating through the walls this morning. Because I can still hear it. Thank you for coming out and sharing your knowledge with us. I'm paraphrasing the letter, but thanks to yours truly, it has been declassified and is now open for all of us to...
For those deep state secrets. Isn't it funny you read a letter like that and you're like, why was this classified to begin with?
So I felt I had 2 feelings. Number one was, like you just said, why in the world was this classified? And the second feeling was, oh, man, I didn't need to see this. This is a personal letter, a thank you written between 2 people, you know, one person thanking the other, and it was none of my business. But because it's the White House, everything is kept and documented and stored in these libraries. because you never know what's going to be relevant at some point. And that is a real testament to those librarians who say, yeah, this is seemingly nothing, but we're going to save it anyway, because one day maybe someone's going to prove ghosts exist, and they're going to go back and they're going to look at all this stuff and want to reference it. And who knows what else is in there that's mentioned. That was all I was looking for, was ghosts in the White House. I didn't look for UFOs or anything else. Maybe that's another project for another day. But that's a testament to the neutrality, I think, of some of the people that store that information, because you just don't know when something will become relevant.
Richard Nixon, again, we mentioned the fact at the beginning of the show he recorded a lot, got in trouble for recording, but he recorded a lot. Did you ever do any research to see if there was any mention of anomalous activity in the White House during the time of Nixon? And if so, what did we find?
Yeah, I know. I checked every presidency, and especially, you know, the presidential libraries is a relatively new phenomenon. Now, every single president gets a library where all of their stuff is stored, and you are allowed to search it and do all kinds of things. And so, no, I checked. I found nothing under the Nixon presidency. I guess they had enough problems to worry about as opposed to ghosts. And it doesn't, you know, some of, like Truman, it comes up again and again and again. And Nixon, there's nothing. And then Ford, there's nothing. Reagan had just a couple of references where he talked about his dog. And then one of the interesting things, and this was in a book that came out years later, George W. Bush, the second Bush president, was in the White House working on his father's reelection campaign. Now, his father was not reelected. He was a one-term president. He was working on his father's reelection campaign and happened to be alone upstairs in the living area of the White House. And he had just exercised. They had some exercise equipment up in one of the rooms on the second floor. And the story goes he had seen a figure step out of the Lincoln bedroom, and he was totally spooked. He had just built up a sweat, working on a stationary bike, had a towel around his neck, sees someone walking down the hall, and is just spooked, runs back to his bedroom, and, you know, that's it for the night. And then, of course, he would go on to live in the building. So,
runs back to his bedroom. How old was he at that time?
Well, he would have been an adult, but...
got to get underneath those covers and pull up the ghost repellent sheets and blankets. When is Mom and Dad going to be home? This is weird.
Hillary Clinton talked about how she said in an interview once, she goes, yeah, at night it can be a pretty spooky place. And then she even said, you know, they think there's a ghost there. And the Obamas apparently had guests and had talked about something like feeling for their feet while they were sleeping in one of the bedrooms upstairs and did some unseen force. Jimmy Carter's daughter was using Ouija boards in the Lincoln bedroom. So it's just, this stuff just keeps coming up again and again. I mean, if you were moving into the White House, I mean, imagine, not that you'd be elected president, but maybe your wife.
Wow.
Has a chance, right?
Well, there's that
chance.
Too honest? Maybe.
Is that too honest? Okay. So imagine you're moving in. Aren't you... You're at least aware of its haunted reputation. You're going to know that. And, I mean, I can't imagine moving in there with young kids being like, so this place is haunted, and this is where we have to live for the next 4 or 8 years. Yeah, that. You know? I mean,
well, the fact is,
though, get curious.
It's not like there were severed heads floating around that we're aware of. Were the employees pretty forthcoming about their experiences?
They were the most forthcoming. So the butlers and so on, they're very apolitical, I found. I don't think these guys watch CNN or Fox News or anything. I don't think you could do your job if you followed politics that closely. But they love history, and they're true patriots. And
well,
the presidency.
You were saying that. I want to hear about some of their experiences that they were willing to talk to you about. All right, Jeff, as we're discussing more and more about the ghosts of the White House, are there many... people that, you know, as you're researching this, are there many people that you find that, you know, you said the president's kind of alluded to it. You had one president that was pretty open about it in his letters back and forth. You said the employees seem to be a lot more forthcoming. But are there other dignitaries? Are there other celebrities and people that have had access to the White House who have also talked about the haunting and having had experiences there?
Yeah, there were two that definitely stick out. Sir Winston Churchill, during World War II, has spent a great deal of time at the White House and stayed there for a number of weeks when they were working on the war effort. And he was at first given the Lincoln bedroom, which is the nicest bedroom you can be offered if you're at the White House. And apparently he felt it was haunted in some way and asked to be moved and didn't go back for the rest of the trip. But Queen Juliana of the Netherlands was there in the 1950s, and she told a story about how she had answered the door at the Lincoln bedroom. She was in her nightclothes. She was asleep. She hears a knock at the door, opens it, and she said, "There's President Lincoln." And then he vanishes. And so it keeps coming up. And one of my favorite Lincoln stories was actually told by one of the foremen named Tony Savoy. And this happened in the post-2000s. He said he was walking down the hall one morning and turning on the lights, which is part of his early morning duties, on the second floor, and he sees Lincoln sitting in a chair in front of the Lincoln bedroom with his legs crossed, his hands folded, three-button spats on his shoes, and just looks at him and then disappears. And so he goes downstairs and tells the assistant usher what he had just seen, and he's told, well, you're not alone. A lot of people have seen Lincoln. The thing about Lincoln is he is distinct, right? We know what this guy looks like. If you need to be reminded, pull out a $5 bill or, in our case, Dave, a penny.
right, yeah. That's more like it.
Right, so pull out a penny and be like, oh, but he doesn't have a copper face. Like, that's weird. We know what Lincoln looks like. He's one of the most distinguished and memorable faces of all the presidents. And so when you see that and you're in the context of the building, it's got to just be life-changing.
Yeah, I would guess so, just in that fact. I mean, especially to have something that historical and significant happen to you. And So Lincoln is the main president that's been seen there. Has there been any other presidents that have been witnessed?
So earlier on, there were a few others. And it's interesting to me, one of the presidents that comes up is William Henry Harrison. As someone had seen his ghost up in the attic area moving through boxes. William Henry Harrison was only president for a month. He caught pneumonia shortly after giving his inauguration speech and spent most of his time sick. So really was only president for, if you think about it, a couple of weeks before he was too ill to even do that. And then he died from the illness. So he left really no mark on the building other than being by far the shortest termed president we've ever had. And yet his ghost story comes up. And
well, sure, also, you've got that unfinished business feel on that story. That one makes sense to me, right?
Quite unfinished business. Business that really never got started to begin with. And then Andrew Jackson is another one too. He comes up and this guy was you gotta realize this guy was different than all the other presidents, especially in the first few centuries of our history. He invited the public into the White House as part of his inaugural reception, and which was a terrible idea because people were stealing things and parts of the curtains and ashtrays and all kinds of stuff. But he was also known for his temper, and he was, Old Hickory was used to getting his way. So his ghost comes up as well, and people hear him. And then Mary Todd Lincoln also witnessed, she thought, which was kind of like a movie playing over again, she witnessed what she thought was a wedding proposal, where she heard Julia marry me. And this was President John Tyler, who had died in 1862, but he was a bachelor president, and he was proposing. She believes she was kind of tuning into him proposing to Julia when he was courting her while he was still president. So, yeah, I think all these presidents leave some kind of mark. It's just over a certain amount of time, most of them go away, but not Lincoln. We don't still hear about William Henry Harrison. We don't still hear about Andrew Jackson or Tyler. But we still hear about Lincoln all these years later. And to me, that's a testament, number one, to how important he was, but it's also a testament to how much we still need him, and we need the lesson of Lincoln.
How many of the employees are able to come forward? And is there any kind of gag order on them for this type of topic?
Well, I don't know so much about a gag order. I only had access to a very limited amount of people because it's the White House. They don't just say, like, well, go ahead, Jeff, and here's the keys. Lock up when you leave, leave the key under the doormat, when you go. So I got to talk to a couple of butlers, a couple of Secret Service agents, and the chief usher, Gary Walters, which was an amazing experience. So I don't think there's so much a gag order, but these are people who are known for keeping their mouth shut. And there's a culture around that building of privacy for the first family and not speaking out about anything that relates to them. If you have your own experience, which has nothing in the world to do with the president, I think they're pretty much okay with you talking about it, obviously being respectful of the history and your position and so on. But otherwise, if it involves the first family at all, like if a president came downstairs and grabbed an usher and said, "I just saw the ghost of Lincoln," that usher would never speak of it because that usher would lose their job. But if the usher saw the ghost with no presidents around, that's different. And I think that's just the culture of it. And that may sound like secret keeping, but at the same time, I got to give him a break on this one because not only would I never want to be president, you are living in a fishbowl. Your every move is documented and watched over by Secret Service and the media and the public and so on. And it's got to be pretty near impossible to have a normal life when you've got a job like that. I can only imagine. And so the only comfort they can give you is just total privacy when you're in that house, when you're staying upstairs, when you're trying to have family time. The best they can do for you is to just, you know, keep your secrets, you know, that you walk around in your boxer shorts holding a beer or whatever, you know, that's the best they can offer you because it's going to be a rough 4 or 8 years.
Who's haunting the White House? The President's Mansion and the ghosts who live there, now in Audible audiobook version. You can find it. It's only $4.87. You can't go wrong. But do me a favor. If you own the hardcover, the paperback, or the audiobook, make sure that you rate and review that because those also help authors like Jeff Belanger as well. And it doesn't cost you anything. If you bought the book in the past or you're about to and you buy it and love it, make sure you go and post something and give them a 5-star review. Tell everybody how great the book is. If you got it and disliked it, keep your damn opinion to yourself, for God's sakes. If you ain't got nothing nice to say, don't say nothing at all. Jeff, before we go, though, I would like, in your words, we had an interesting experience in Virginia City, Nevada. And you and I have had a chance to investigate
a lot. Whoa, Dave.
What? It was college. We were experimenting. No, we've had a chance to investigate a lot of cool places around the United States together. And we're looking at possibly doing another one here together in the near future at the two Lizzie Borden houses. So that's something people can keep checking up on for darknessevents.com. Hopefully we're going to get something ironed out for that. But we were in Virginia City and doing hard time in the Virginia City jail.
Right.
We were stationed there for, I think, what was it? It was some insane
like
amount of
eight
time.
8 hours.
8 hours of investigating.
Yeah, from like 8 to 4 or something, 8 p.m. to 4 a.m.,
Right, with all of these different people that had come to this conference. And, we would hear things and maybe see things from time to time, but I'd like for you to relate to the audience because I've mentioned it in the past, but I'd like for your words, kind of explain how our evening ended up and what might have occurred.
Well, so I think in the all fairness of full disclosure, the day started at a wedding, like a noontime wedding, where there may or may not have been a lot of alcohol. And so that's at noon. And so we had all afternoon to get ready / sober up. And so we were pretty wiped out when the thing even started. But as the night goes on, it's interesting. It's this old jail, and there's like two stories of cells. There's like a first floor. It's a jail. It's not a prison. So the difference is like this is where you stay until you get arraigned and go through court and so on, and then you would either move on to a prison or you'd be set free. So I don't know what it was about. Maybe 8 cells on each floor, 16 total, something like that.
Yeah.
Sound about right? Yeah. So we're in there, and it's dark, and it's late, and it gets to be about the last hour of 8 hours of investigating after the day we had already had. And I look over, and I see this shadow moving up on the second floor between these two cells, like very distinct, like dark shadow was like going by the white wall into the next cell and then back. And I'm like, "Dave, do you see that? Do you see that shadow moving?" And you look over and you go, "Yep, but we're so tired and so overworked that who knows?" And I just went, "Yeah, you're probably right. It could have been Beelzebub himself up there," and we just walked away.
Isn't it funny, though? Here it is. Not only, if just one of us saw it, there's a good chance it's because we're so tired. But what didn't seem rational to both of us is, at the time, we're both witnessing the exact same thing. And our rationalization is, we can't even trust ourselves. We're too tired at this point. But, there were things moving. We saw things moving. That was a weird moment.
I know, but I stand by that because when you're that overtired, you're right. just not in a good headspace. And I've had experiences like that, and other, not even ghost hunting, where I've gone like 2 days without sleep, and I said, is that painting melting off the wall, or am I just that tired? And
right. But for two people to both be watching the painting melt might mean that there's something else going on. That's,
you're right.
That's the weird aspect. But it was so funny. We get sometimes so unaffected by the paranormal. And when I do these live events, I have to tell you, and I know you and I both become jaded to the point, it's like kind of at points you almost need like the flying severed flaming head flying down the hall at you to re-engage you in this field. Because we'll go in and, somebody's brand new and they've just caught an EVP of a get out. And you and I are like, yeah, okay. What else you got?
A good one.
Right. And right. These people, that's a religious experience for some of these people. And you and I are just kind of these jaded jerk offs at this point because we've heard it, we've seen it. But then you get that shake up, that shake and bake once in a while that reminds you, my God, this field is exciting. This is interesting. And I've got to keep checking it out and investigating and educating myself on this. And that's probably the most important part of doing all of this. It's the education process, which I know sounds so boring to people, but I promise you, then when you have an experience, it is going to be so much more profound because you have educated yourself. You're not front loading. You're not, creating something to imagine, but now you have something to contextualize with the experience that you have. And to me, that's what's made this field continue after 13 years of doing this, to be really exciting for me.
No, I get it. Sometimes it's just one little spark that some little weird thing that happens where you're like, oh man, I'm all in again, sometimes it's a project I start researching where you just start going, wow, this is really exciting. This is something that speaks to a really primal part of me. And that's what the paranormal is. We're asking the biggest questions ever. When you talk about space and UFOs, you're asking, are we alone in the universe? When you talk about Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster, you're asking, do we know every creature that shares our planet with us? When you talk about ghosts, you're asking, what happens after we die? These are the biggest questions humans have ever asked.
Right.
And we get to ponder them, day in and day out, and we get to explore them and roll our sleeves up and actually stick our hands into it. And that is the best part. And that's what I love about this. And I can't imagine doing anything else.
We will put up a link to the book. We'll also put up a link to Jeff's website so you can find him there. And, Jeff, just to remind listeners, tell them about New England Legends, the podcast.
Yeah, so I've been doing this weekly podcast now since August, and it's a short story every week. They're about 10 minutes long. It's produced. We don't really have guests. It's just a research story that I've been doing, and it's there every week. It's New England Legends. If you subscribe, you can get it for free on iTunes or Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcasts. And it's been so much fun. If you've seen me give lectures and things like that where I tell these stories about various haunts, it's kind of like that, except a weekly story in audio form from somewhere in New England. So check it out. It's totally free.
And if you have the Darkness Radio app through the Google Play Store, it is part of our app. As a matter of fact, you just scroll down the Legends. You can click it. You can listen and check it out. But I encourage you, all of our Army of Darkness, you love Darkness Radio, you love the strange, you love the supernatural, go listen to Jeff's show. He's fantastic. They put together a great little program, and it's anywhere between 6 to 15 minutes long. Each program comes out every week, and you're going to learn something. You're going to have a great time, and there's some really spooky stuff that they've covered. As a matter of fact, again, thank you for allowing us to play the episode a few weeks ago in our Theater of the Mind segment. It was really cool to kind of share
Freddy.
That. Yeah, Fingernail Freddy to share that with the audience. So check it out. Be a part of it. We will be back Monday with more supernatural news and parashare right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.